The Black Revolt of the 1950s and 1960s, North and South, came as a surprise. But perhaps it should not have. The memory of oppressed people is one thing that cannot be taken away. And for such people, with such memories, revolt is always an inch below the surface. For blacks in the United States, there was the memory of slavery, and after that, of segregation, lynching, humiliation. And it was not just a memory, but a living presence, part of the daily lives of blacks in generation after generation. In the 1930s, Langston Hughes wrote a poem, Lenox Avenue Mural. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over? Like a syrupy sweet. Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode? In a society of complex controls, both crude and refined, secret thoughts can often be found in the arts, and so it was in black society. Perhaps the blues, however pathetic, concealed anger, and the jazz, however joyful, portended rebellion. And then the poetry, the thoughts no longer so secret. In the 1920s, Claude McKay, one of the figures of what came to be called the Harlem Renaissance, wrote a poem that Henry Cabot Lodge put in the Congressional Record as an example of dangerous currents among young blacks. If we must die, let it not be like hogs, hunted and penned in an inglorious spot. Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back. County Cullen's poem, Incident, evoked memories, all different, all the same, out of every black American's childhood. Once riding in old Baltimore, heart filled, head filled with glee, I saw a Baltimorean keep looking straight at me. Now I was 8 and very small, and he was no whit bigger, and so I smiled, but he poked out his tongue and called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until December. Of all the things that happened there, that's all that I remember. At the time of the Scottsboro Boys incident, Cullen wrote a bitter poem noting that white poets had used their pens to protest in other cases of injustice. But now that blacks were involved, most were silent. His last stanza was, "Surely I said, now will the poets sing, but they have raised no cry. I wonder why." Even outward subservience, Uncle Tom behavior in real situations, the comic or fawning Negro on the stage, the self-ridicule, the caution, concealed resentment, anger, energy. The black poet Paul Laurence Dunbar, in the era of the black minstrel around the turn of the century, wrote, "We wear the mask. We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. We sing, but oh, the clay is vile. Beneath our feet and long the mile. But let the world dream otherwise. We wear the mask." Two black performers of that time played the minstrel and satirized it at the same time. When Burt Williams and George Walker billed themselves as two real coons, they were, Nathan Huggins says, intending to give style and comic dignity to a fiction that white men had created. By the 1930s, the mask was off for many black poets. Langston Hughes wrote, I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes. But I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow I'll be at the table when company comes. Gwendolyn Bennett wrote, "I want to see lithe Negro girls etch dark against the sky while sunset lingers. I want to hear the chanting around a heathen fire of a strange black race. I want to feel the surging of my sad people's soul hidden by a minstrel smile." There was Margaret Walker's prose poem, For My People. "Let a new earth rise, let another world be born. Let a bloody peace be written in the sky. Let a second generation full of courage issue forth. Let a people loving freedom come to growth. Let a beauty full of healing and a strength of final clenching be the pulsing in our spirits and our blood. Let the martial songs be written, let the dirges disappear. Let a race of men now rise and take control." By the 1940s, there was Richard Wright, a gifted novelist, a black man. His autobiography of 1937, Black Boy, gave endless insights. For instance, how blacks were set against one another, when he told how he was prodded to fight another black boy for the amusement of white men. Black Boy expressed unashamedly every humiliation, and then, "The White South said that it knew niggers, and I was what the White South called a nigger. Well, the White South had never known me, never known what I thought, what I felt. The White South said that I had a place in life. Well, I had never felt my place, or rather, my deepest instincts had always made me reject the place to which the White South had assigned me. It had never occurred to me that I was in any way an inferior being, and no word that I had ever heard fall from the lips of Southern white men had ever made me really doubt the worth of my own humanity. It was all there in the poetry, the prose, the music, sometimes masked, sometimes unmistakably clear, the signs of a people unbeaten, waiting, hot, coiled. In Black Boy, Wright told about the training of black children in America to keep them silent, but also, how do Negroes feel about the way they have to live? How do they discuss it when alone among themselves? I think this question can be answered in a single sentence, a friend of mine who ran an elevator once told me. Lord, man, if it wasn't for them polices and them old lynch mobs, there wouldn't be nothing but uproar down here. Richard Wright, for a time, joined the Communist Party. He tells of this period of his life and his disillusionment with the party in The God That Failed. The Communist Party was known to pay special attention to the problem of race equality. When the Scottsboro case unfolded in the 1930s in Alabama, it was the Communist Party that had become associated with the defense of these young black men imprisoned in the early years of the Depression by Southern injustice. The party was accused by liberals and the NAACP of exploiting the issue for its own purposes, and there was a half-truth in it. But black people were realistic about the difficulty of having white allies who were pure in motive. The other half of the truth was that black communists in the South had earned the admiration of blacks by their organizing work against enormous obstacles. There was Hosea Hudson, the black organizer of the unemployed in Birmingham, for instance. And in Georgia in 1932, a 19-year-old black youth named Angelo Herndon, whose father died of miner's pneumonia, who had worked in mines as a boy in Kentucky, joined an unemployment council in Birmingham organized by the Communist Party, and then joined the party. He wrote later, "All my life I'd been sweated and stepped on and Jim Crowed. I lay on my belly in the mines for a few dollars a week and saw my pay stolen and slashed and my buddies killed. I lived in the worst section of town and rode behind the colored signs on streetcars as though there was something disgusting about me. I heard myself called nigger and darky, and I had to say yes, sir, to every white man, whether he had my respect or not. I had always detested it, but I had never known that anything could be done about it. And here, all of a sudden, I had found organizations in which Negroes and whites sat together and worked together and knew no difference of race or color." Herndon became a Communist Party organizer in Atlanta. He and his fellow communists organized block committees of unemployment councils in 1932, which got rent relief for needy people. They organized a demonstration to which 1,000 people came, 600 of them white, and the next day the city voted $6,000 in relief to the jobless. But soon after that, Herndon was arrested, held incommunicado, and charged with violating a Georgia statute against insurrection. He recalled his trial. "The state of Georgia displayed the literature that had been taken from my room and read passages of it to the jury. They questioned me in great detail. Did I believe that the bosses in government ought to pay insurance to unemployed workers? That Negroes should have complete equality with white people? Did I believe in the demand for the self-determination of the Black Belt that the Negro people should be allowed to rule the Black Belt territory, kicking out the white landlords and government officials? Did I feel that the working class could run the mills and mines in government? That it wasn't necessary to have bosses at all? I told them I believed all of that, and more." Herndon was convicted and spent 5 years in prison, until in 1937 the Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional the Georgia statute under which he was found guilty. It was men like him who represented to the establishment a dangerous militancy among blacks, made more dangerous when linked with the Communist Party. There were others who made that same connection, magnifying the danger. Benjamin Davis, the black lawyer who defended Herndon at his trial, nationally renowned men like singer and actor Paul Robeson, and writer and scholar W.E.B. Du Bois, who did not hide their support and sympathy for the Communist Party. The Negro was not as anti-communist as the white population. He could not afford to be. His friends were so few. So that Herndon, Davis, Robeson, Du Bois, however their political views might be maligned by the country as a whole, found admiration for their fighting spirit in the black community. The black militant mood, flashing here and there in the 30s, was reduced to a subsurface simmering during World War II, when the nation on the one hand denounced racism, and on the other hand maintained segregation in the armed forces and kept blacks in low-paying jobs. When the war ended, a new element entered the racial balance in the United States, the enormous, unprecedented upsurge of black and yellow people in Africa and Asia. President Harry Truman had to reckon with this, especially as the Cold War rivalry with the Soviet Union began, and the dark-skinned revolt of former colonies all over the world threatened to take Marxist form. Action on the race question was needed, not just to calm a black population at home emboldened by war promises, frustrated by the basic sameness of their condition. It was needed to present to the world a United States that could counter the continuous communist thrust at the most flagrant failure of American society, the race question. What Du Bois had said long ago, unnoticed, now loomed large in 1945. The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. President Harry Truman, in late 1946, appointed a committee on civil rights, which recommended that the civil rights section of the Department of Justice be expanded, that there be a permanent commission on civil rights, that Congress pass laws against lynching and to stop voting discrimination, and suggested new laws to end racial discrimination in jobs. Truman's committee was blunt about its motivation in making these recommendations. Yes, it said, there was moral reason, a matter of conscience, but there was also an economic reason. Discrimination was costly to the country, wasteful of its talent, and perhaps most important, there was an international reason. Our position in the post-war world is so vital to the future that our smallest actions have far-reaching effects. We cannot escape the fact that our civil rights record has been an issue in world politics. The world's press and radio are full of it. Those with competing philosophies have stressed and are shamelessly distorting our shortcomings. They have tried to prove our democracy an empty fraud and our nation a consistent oppressor of underprivileged people. This may seem ludicrous to Americans, but it is sufficiently important to worry our friends. The United States is not so strong. The final triumph of the democratic ideal is not so inevitable that we can ignore what the world thinks of us or our record.